Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
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 Yes, sci-fi, 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 in which three extraordinarily disturbed gentlemen talk about one book at the same time, sometimes chanting in unison.
And wondering if we all read the same book.
Exactly. What are we reading today, Mr. Kevin?
Who Goes There by John Campbell. Although it was published under a pseudonym originally, apparently.
Would you grace us with the summary?
I could do that. Who Goes There by John Campbell, published in 1938 in Astounding Science Fiction under the pen name of Don A. Stewart. From the quote back of the book, the novella that formed the basis of The Thing is the John Campbell classic about Antarctic research camp that discovers and thaws the ancient frozen body of a crash-landed alien. The creature revives with terrifying results, shape-shifting to assume the exact form of animal and man alike. Paranoia ensues as a band of frightened men work to discern friend from foe and destroy the menace before it challenges all of humanity. The story, hailed as one of the finest science fiction novellas ever written by the SF writers of America, is best known to fans as The Thing. As it was the basis of Howard Hawks' The Thing from Another World in 1951 and John Carpenter's The Thing in 1982.
Okay, well, that...
That's not very spoiler-free.
You're the one who read it.
I know, but I didn't read it myself before I read it.
Thus denoting our lack of preparation on a weekly basis.
It was a real-time reading, or a cold reading, or some other name for it.
Yes. Also, I should announce to the listeners that as a special feature of this particular episode, one of us has been replaced with an alien.
Me.
Or all of us.
At least one of us has been replaced by an alien.
We could burn it with fire to make sure.
Let's just burn us all just to make sure. Barry's not sure what he thinks about this.
There's so many pros and cons to this.
All right, Barry, what did you think?
I liked it. You know, as mentioned, this is our first novella that we've ever reviewed, so it went by really quickly. I think it was only about 2.5 hours, yeah, as the audiobook flies.
Sure.
But I did enjoy it. I've never read it before, and I think I've only seen a part of the original Thing movie, so I really wasn't quite sure what to expect other than Antarctica and some sort of creature.
Right. You mean the 80s one or the 1950s?
The 50s version.
Oh, wow. You hadn't seen the 80s one?
The magic carrot version?
No, I have no idea what you're talking about. From the part I did see, I definitely got a different feel from listening to the actual book versus the movie itself, which I think was called out in the early part of the intro to this book.
Right.
They said that the first movie was not very faithful to the book.
Right. He kind of ragged on it.
It has a different feel and texture to the rising action.
Well, yeah, 1950s morphing technology was not quite up there.
Well, yeah, I only vaguely remember, but I do remember something about, you know, the carrot from space. So I think maybe that's what the monster looked like or something.
Well, they called it that because it was supposed to be vegetative in nature.
Ah, okay. I guess that makes more sense. I've seen it, but I really don't remember anything at all about it. I've seen the second, or I guess it wasn't the second according to Wikipedia, but the John Carpenter one, that was like one of the movies, one of my favorite horror movies as a kid, you know. Whatever.
Yeah, that is one of my favorite horror movies because it's one of the few horror movies that has actually made me go, gah.
Yeah, it was one of those like, I don't think mass works that way, but okay, I'll run with it. You know, it's the thing seems to generate mass like rather quickly.
Is that your general way of approaching horror movies?
No, but it does seem to be a way I approach everything. And as usual, there's in the movie, there's a callback to, at the time it wasn't a callback, but there was an Apple II hidden as a chess machine, which I remember since I'd watched it so many times way back then.
I believe we have a new usual question.
Is there an Apple II?
Is there an Apple II playing chess?
Yeah. So I remember the scene where Kurt Russell, you know, who doesn't he play? Was it MacReady or whatever? I forget. But
yes.
You know, at the beginning, it's trying to show how kind of bored they are, right? You know, in this outpost in the Antarctic, and so he's playing chess. you know, he loses, he like, I think dumps his drink into the front panel, like sparks out as per, you know, cinematics, you know, says cheating bitch or something along those lines. And I kept thinking at the time, that doesn't seem very realistic, because if you were stuck down there, you might, you know, you might not want to destroy one of your few forms of entertainment.
This has been Apple II Chess Theater with Kevin.
On directly to the spoiler section.
Yes. So before we go there, I actually like this more than I really expected. I had read it before when I was back in high school. I remember reading it in the library during a free period. It was just a random book that I found. And I liked it a lot better on the reread, though I had certainly, you know, thought it was a classic the first time around. And even rereading it, I sort of, there were a couple of times where I just sort of had this sort of visceral gah feeling. Yeah. Because you really get the feeling that, oh, I'm made of slime, and everything is made of slime and could transform at the slightest provocation to something horrible. And you don't even know if your friends are real.
Right. It definitely calls up that, you know, whatever the official name of that trope is, but, you know, basically like the trapped in a contained kind of space and you don't know who you can trust and there's a murder or something horrible happening. And
we call it life.
Indeed.
You're all trapped here on the planet with me. True statement.
All right. Well, so I think that that plays us out in terms of the review section. So we shall take a break and come back for our spoilerful discussion section.
Spoilerful.
Sci-fi.
And we're back.
Yes.
So this is our spoiler section where we discuss terrifying possibilities that we have found inside this novella. One thing that I wanted to bring up was I thought that this was sort of like an answer to Lovecraft in a way. That Campbell was taking on a lot of the Lovecraftian themes, such as corruption from within and being sort of faced with some kind of alien presence and being turned sort of horrible and inhuman from it. But instead, they face good old-fashioned American know-how. And you know, at first, it really just seems like we're completely overwhelmed because they come up with a scientific way of dealing with it. But the thing is far smarter than we are, and it's psychic. I want to talk about that a little bit later. Yep. And it completely outfoxes us. I mean, it's practically laughing at us. For example, not only does it manage to mess up the test with the dogs, so originally they try to do a serum test with the dogs.
Well, use the dog's blood to prove that you're a human or not, whether it reacts or not.
Exactly. And one of the people that volunteers to be a test human is the thing.
Right, so that they basically said, well, it responds to humans and aliens, so we don't know, doesn't do anything really. Right.
Oh, and by the way, the rest of the dogs are things now.
Right.
So we can't do anything about that. But then they come up with another test, something that, you know, got hinted at, but, you know, the idea that, oh, well, any piece of this creature that is separated becomes a completely independent creature, and this thing is so selfish that it will respond independently, so it'll stop playing dead. So American know-how is able to turn it around and separate the humans from the aliens in the end. If this were a Lovecraft story, it would have been a really short story about, am I human? Oh, the hand!
At the end, he would just be sort of depressed and...
Right, exactly.
Contemplating things.
But I'm not really sure if it was a conscious attempt at looking at Lovecraftian themes, but I think it kind of functions that way.
Well, what did we say? It was 35 or 38 something, mm-hmm. I forget now. And so, 38. So that's written after Lovecraft, but not by a lot.
Right. So I think that he's trying out kind of a weird fiction mode there, but is also putting it into basically a genre which demands that science and humanity wins out in the end.
Well, I kind of, you know, after you mentioned the Lovecraft thing, I was kind of thinking about that a little bit. And one of the things I felt like was that it was just more hard science.
Right.
That was sort of injected into the storyline. Right. Normally when you have like a Lovecraft story, right? It's, there's sort of like some basic science. And this was, you know, hey, we have, you know, a meteorologist, we have a, you know, I'm just looking at the list here of people.
Men. Yeah.
A biologist, a, you know, physicist, two physicists, and a doctor. And,
you know, this never occurred to me. Why was there a biologist in the North Pole?
Magnetometers.
Right.
Yeah, they never really explained what they were doing there, right? I mean, they were doing some kind of research, but we don't know what it was.
Right. They were doing magnetism research, and that makes sense for the physicists.
We brought the Science Academy.
But maybe it's just like, well, just in case, you know, maybe there's something in the ice or something.
Yeah, I think sending biologists to Antarctica is a serious just in case, but I'm willing to overlook it. I'm sure they explain it.
Was the biologist also the doctor?
No, there were two separate characters.
Okay. I mean, maybe they just brought him along and, hey, maybe he'll serve double duty as, you know, in case the dogs get sick or...
Yeah, but they did have the doctor. One of the things that I actually found a bit of a problem with the story is that just there were so many characters, it was difficult to keep track of who was who, and they're all just sort of manly men being very, very manly, so it's hard to sort of differentiate. Well, they were kind of color-coded.
All men are that way, right? We're all manly men.
I love the description of MacReady as, he was a bronze statue come to life.
Kurt Russell, right? yeah, I actually was just going to say that I wish I had sort of a graphical chart timeline of like who was who when, who got infected when and stuff, because I totally don't understand who was really infected, who they thought was infected.
I honestly don't think that he kept track, because I went back and I was listening to just try to figure out, okay, who was an alien and who was a human at that point.
Right.
And we know that Conant, I guess the physicist that sat up with it all night, there's a good solid hint that he was transformed immediately, because they had that description from his viewpoint of, oh, he didn't notice when the alien's eyes were no longer unseeing and didn't notice it sneaking up on him.
So, you know, there's the guy that they lock out into that, you know, shed somewhere.
Right.
Who was that? And... you know, was he infected the entire time, or did I misunderstand that? Because it sounded like that's where they were building that thing that didn't show up in the movies. But
yeah, by the way, be careful how you use the word thing in this book.
Yes. Hey, the thing is not used in the book, just in the movies.
It's used all over the place. They call it the thing.
Well,
a lot.
They do, but I mean, that wasn't the title, is all I mean.
Yes. Thank you. Barry, you look like you're either going to kill us all or you have something to say, or maybe both.
Just one of you.
Can't decide.
Whichever one. You're like, I don't know, human, alien.
Whoever I get to first.
I think I'm closer, but...
Yes. Yeah, that's one of my criticisms, is even going back and sort of knowing the ending and knowing who's an alien and who isn't, at least theoretically, in the end, it's very hard to figure out, okay, so the alien got to Conant, the physicist... But it seemed like by the next scene, because the doctor donates blood, the captain donates blood, the captain jumps up and volunteers, and I believe that the doctor turns out to be human in the end. So
that means the captain must have been...
The captain must already be an alien at that point.
So yeah, it's definitely kind of messing with him then. If you know, he kind of points out, hey, you should do this. And then it's like, well, by the nature that you said that, that kind of implies that you're human too. And...
Right, exactly.
You know, or was it just trying to kind of play, you know, a game at that point, you know, of uncertainty? Or
no. The doctor was human, and the doctor suggested the serum test.
Right, but then the captain sort of says, okay, well, then I'll step down because you can't trust whether I'm human or not, even though I know I'm human and stuff like that. Like,
right, and of course, a lot of that is just the alien is doing a perfect imitation, and also it doesn't have any loyalty towards other versions of itself, it seems.
Right.
And it also seems like the people that are involved are spend a fair amount of time convincing themselves they're right.
Yeah.
Which was sort of like an interesting thing for me, right? It's like, well, yeah, we just talked ourselves into it, and you kind of realize how much you do that to yourself every day.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I wrote down about this book was sort of, even from the very beginning, the rationalization element of it, right? It's like, well, we have a plan. We're going to execute the plan. The plan's going to tell us who's an alien and who's not, right? They sort of had a lot of, you know, in the beginning, through most of the book, a lot of faith in the test until it proved itself to be wrong.
Right.
Yeah. And like, oh, crap.
I mean, maybe that's part of what you're saying is like, you know, we're America and
right, exactly.
We're awesome and this is always going to work.
Well, they're not only Americans. They're Americans in a science fiction 1930s golden age story where science is going to get us out of this problem.
Right.
And it was kind of unusual that the first attempt didn't work. But yeah, what I think was going on in that first scene, to backtrack a little bit, was that one of the reasons that the captain stepped up and said, I'll be the other volunteer to give you blood, is that he knew that it would make the test completely useless.
Right.
But exactly how Conant got to him or some other portion of the alien had gotten to him that quickly, unless basically it had been running around all night swapping people, then, you know, it's hard to tell. There's no way of just saying, oh, first it was this guy, and then it was this right. guy, and this guy, and then it was this guy, and this guy. I think that he may not actually have even known which one was an alien and which wasn't until he started testing people at the end, you know,
right.
fictionally
maybe,
as well. As,
maybe it didn't really make a difference. You know, right. It was more. Yeah.
I mean, I think it was mostly a postulation, right? I mean, he doesn't know. He wants to know, but.
Sorry, by he, I mean, in this case, I don't even think that Campbell, the author, knew.
Oh, I see.
Or was necessarily keeping close track. He knew that Conant was, but sort of got to the end and said, yeah, I think this one was an alien. I think that it would make a bigger narrative point right now if this person was an alien. I'm not entirely sure that he had it densely plotted out as to exactly who became an alien when.
Right. Yeah, so is there, I mean, I'll start, but, you know, maybe we can do that. You know, is there a scene that stood out? You know, it is a short book, so there might be overlap. But, I mean, probably the one that stood out for me, but partly because of, you know, watching the movie so much, was the, you know, the final test that works where he has that, like, hot wire, like, that right. he pokes into the blood, and it kind of, like, you know, leaps out like an amoeba or something like that and kind of squeals and, like...
The interesting thing is it sort of shows, to me... what word processing has done to writing fiction, because that wasn't the first test that actually showed an alien. There had been a previous person that had failed the test, and they just said, oh, go ahead, kill him. And then it seemed like a little bit later, Campbell had come up with, oh, this is what it should do. It'd be awesome if the blood actually screamed.
And then it did, because it didn't scream the first time, or...
I'm sure it did scream. He just didn't describe it.
Yeah, he didn't notice or something. Like
No. I mean the author literally didn't right. describe that. And,
okay, I see what you're saying. That, you know, assuming he's typewriting it, it's like, oh, that would mean I have to retype this page. Like, forget that.
Yeah, exactly.
But I thought that one of the things they mentioned in the foreword that they had for the book was that the editor was really, you know, very, you know, strong-handed about making sure that everything was correct. This seems like something that the editor would have called out and...
I'm not really saying that anything was wrong. I'm just saying that he had this really vivid description of the successful test, the blood screaming. But in the previous paragraph, the guy fails the test, and they simply don't describe what happened.
Okay.
That just says, oh, well, then I put the wire in and get him.
Yes. I wonder if that's a function of the book coming to a rapid close or, you know, sort of that, you know, the final action.
Absolutely. Actually, my favorite scene was right before then, actually, was they had just killed the first person that they'd realized was an alien.
And just by kind of like ripping him apart, that seemed a little ambiguous.
Yeah, by ripping apart. I didn't really love that part.
Yeah, you're like, well, that's part, in the movie at least they just burned them, because that part I'm like, I don't know if I would believe that would kill the alien, but okay, I'll run with it.
Well, then they like put acid on all the parts stuff or something like that. But in the next scene, they have this character sitting down saying... Oh my God, I would have sworn that that was a perfectly good man. These are more than just imitations, you know, this is of the devil. And then that guy turns out to be an alien, and that's the guy whose blood screams. So I think that maybe, if I don't think that Campbell just came up with that description a little bit later than he wanted to and didn't want to retype the whole page to make that happen first, I think that he was heightening the dramatic moment of, right. okay, this guy who we've just convinced you, the reader, has to be human because he right. has had this tremendous emotional reaction to killing off what he thought was a human being. Then we're putting this really dramatic description of the failed test.
Right.
One thing I did want to talk about was, this is, of course, a really, really hard science fiction story, but Campbell threw in psychic phenomena. Now, that was considered somewhat scientific back in the day.
Right. Like it was a real thing. It wasn't just like, oh, well, those wacky people, like, you know.
Right. But there's a particular reason for it. Campbell had gone to Duke University and he had graduated from there. I think he only spent a year there or something. But Campbell had attended a lecture by J.B. Rhine, who was one of the early guys that was into psychic testing. And Rhine did the kind of testing that was in the beginning of the original Ghostbusters, with the cards with the wavy lines and all of that. Those are the Zener cards that he came up with. And ironically, Rhine himself had been convinced into looking into psychic phenomena by attending a lecture by Arthur Conan Doyle, the renowned...
He wrote something about whatever.
Author and spiritualist and believer in tinkly little fairies. So Campbell thought of this as really hard science because it was given to him by an academic figure that was, you know, more or less believed in at the time. Later on, people tried to reproduce Rhine's research and no dice, nothing. Basically, we figured out that every time the tests weren't going well, then would stick the test results in a file drawer somewhere saying, oh, obviously you're not having a good day. Let's check again when you're more psychic tomorrow.
It comes and goes.
Yes. I can psychically predict a coin flip 50% of the time.
Roughly.
Roughly.
I'd never even heard of this, the other adaptation, the 1972 Horror Express, which sounds like it doesn't have a lot to do with it, but...
Sorry,
I know, it's a little bit of a swerve there, but...
Well, I just sort of thought of the Andrew Lloyd Webber...
God, version... The Thing.
Horror Express. Oh, answer me, yes.
But it has Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing in it, amusingly.
Okay, I'm still thinking of a musical.
It could still have them in it, yes. Anyway, so Barry, was there a scene that stood out? Or
I think that the scene that stuck out most for me was when they sort of suddenly realized that, you know, what this the creature was capable of doing, and they're sort of, you know, talking about it, and like, well, it's basically going to be a perfect replica of whatever it wants to be, and sort of everybody's reaction to it, and they're like, you know, oh, that can't possibly be, and he's like, yeah, that's exactly what's going on here, which is why it's, you know, basically, you know, outthinking us at every turn.
Right.
So yeah, that one thing that, you know, wasn't in at least the John Carpenter film was that little thing at the end where it was like, it took little bits and parts of their equipment and, you know, right. Snow or something like that, and
what
made
it,
some
the,
like
the anti-grav,
anti-gravity orb using, like, you know, the power of the atom and stuff like that, you know. And but it was a little bit less cheesy than you normally think of as when they talk about the power of the atom, you know, from, you know, that kind of era stuff. But, you know.
Well, it was the 1930s also. They came by it honestly.
Well, right. I mean, I guess what I mean is it's a little bit in between. It's not technological as far as, you know, people are concerned. It's like a little bit like, you know, future science. So it's sort of like, well, you know, there's this ball of energy. It's not like a machine that he built exactly.
Right. And he basically was talking a lot about neutrons at that point.
Yeah.
But referred to it as a ball of pure force.
Right. And that, you know, they were worried about the albatross that was flying overhead, that it was going to grab it and fly off and take over the world. But they're like, well, okay, we really kept it, you know, on the ground because it was making this, you know, anti-gravity jacket to fly around in or something. Yeah, they didn't seem too concerned that they, you know, because, okay, so like way back at the beginning, they were trying to get into this ship that was supposedly they figured out was made of magnesium somehow.
Well, they figured it out by lighting it on fire.
Yeah. And then it's like, oh, it really went up. So I guess it was magnesium, but yeah, they couldn't get in with any of their tools and stuff. And
yeah, at this point, it would be kind of hard to imagine a research team discovering something like this and immediately saying, okay, well, let's fire off the explosives.
I know. It feels very... you know, like mummy unwrapping party level of science, you know?
Yeah. I mean, this was, again, the 1930s.
Right.
This was not necessarily unrealistic, even though it was terrible.
So, you know, given that it's in the 30s, right, the Rutherford model was described in the 20s, 1920, right, which is the model is that there's positive, negative, and neutral particles, you know, that comprise atoms. So, you know, they're probably all sort of, you know, kind of digesting this stuff and trying to figure out how to use it in their books and...
Right.
You know, this is the hard science part, right? How do you integrate this into your book? And, you know, this is the, you know, fantastic power source. It's neutrons. It's a ball of force. It's a sphere of annihilation.
Right. And I think somebody on Wikipedia pointed out that electricity was still considered kind of a neat new technology. And that's why there's so much, you know, electrical zap pow in this, you know, oh, there's a magnetic source and we're killing the monster with electricity.
Yeah, there's, I would assume that, you know, probably up even until the late 30s, he would sort of get this idea of, you know, people kind of understand how it works, but probably are filling in a lot of the blanks on their own and, right, and making wild conjectures about things.
To be fair, we still, most people still barely understand electricity these days.
It right. makes things go, like the car.
Yep.
Good strong. Job, Barry.
I am packed.
Yeah, even like, you know, H.P. Lovecraft and a lot of his stuff, you know, that was kind of, you know, along lines when sort of quantum theory and stuff was kind of being popularized in the press to some degree. And so there's stuff in Lovecraft stories where they talk about, you know, quantum effects and things like that. So, right. Which when I first read that, I was not expecting that because I hadn't really consciously sort of like matched the dates in my head. And so mm-hmm. I was kind of like, it was very like unexpected to hear them mention that in the story. But
see, was there anything else we wanted to talk about?
Nothing specific. It's funny because it does kind of make me want to read Invasion of the Bodysnatchers again. I don't know yeah. if you read that or not, but...
Oh, let me think. The closest that I've read to this is actually Philip K. Dick had Colony. I don't know when that came out. Must have been lighter. But Colony was sort of the opposite. It was an alien that could take the form of any non-living item. So it could take the form of a file cabinet, for example, and then anytime you were left alone in the room with inanimate objects, they would reach out and grab you.
Sounds very PKD.
Very much so, yes.
So I think this book has held up over time.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I agree. The prose was a bit more flowery than I remembered in some parts, particularly when he was describing the characters as, you know, sort of color-coded. But
yeah,
the thing about it was that the descriptions were really vivid in some ways, and they would kind of sneak up on me because a lot of his most powerful phrasing was when he was a little bit unadorned and just said, the thing in the test tube screamed.
Right, it's a very stark description.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the descriptions of the stuff that definitely directly translated to the Carpenter film, where they had sort of the thing transforming, like the dogs who was like sort of like painted red and had like, you know, a ridge of teeth around the perimeter or something like that, you know, and that kind of directly went into the Carpenter film like that. And
right.
And that I remember in the film especially was particularly graphic and yeah. sort of disturbing.
One thing that I thought that the Carpenter film did that I don't remember happening in the novel was that the Carpenter film gave a solid reason for understanding that a piece of the creature would act independently, because after one of their fights, they realized, oh, one of the, you know, the pieces that must act independently, but they never showed that happening in the same way that they did in that really visceral scene where the head comes off and tries to attack them.
Oh, right. In the movie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they do talk about it a little bit in the book, and there were a few where they had some graphic descriptions of, you know, blue, like ooze and stuff like that, you know, and things right. like that. But, yeah, it's funny that, you know, when I was reading the book, it also reminded me, and I'm sure this was taken directly, was that early X-Files episode.
Yes.
Like Ice, I think, or something.
Yeah, that's one of the things they mentioned in the foreword.
Mm, okay, yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
Right. It's been generally acknowledged that Ice was a deliberate ripoff of this, but with a much less effects budget.
Yes.
Although they originally wrote that script thinking, oh, well, yeah, this will be really cheap. It's just, you know, all in these same rooms and, you know, just a little bit of special effects, but it turned out that one went over budget as well.
As usual.
Speaking of usual, do we want to do our usual questions?
Sure. So, was there tea? I don't remember there being any tea whatsoever, and I'm kind of happy about that.
I don't think there was.
They didn't have tea back then, Steve.
It was PT, pre-tea.
Pre-tea. Were there any awkward sex scenes?
That depends on the alien's view of things.
Right. There's asexual reproduction, probably, but
Okay. I'm going to stay out of this one. I'm going to let you two dig.
Nothing that made me pull the car over and come to a stop.
You're like, oh, I have to throw up now.
Yeah. Anything else we want to talk about?
Nope.
Have you read anything else, or is there anything famous that this author has done? Because I'm sure he has, but I can't really remember.
Well, he was the editor of one of the big science fiction magazines. He's basically one of the most seminal figures in science fiction, because in order to be published, you had to get him to sign off on your work. So he isn't necessarily well known for his own work that much. He's largely known for everybody else in the entire world having to get his approval to get their stuff published.
Interesting. So he does have a... It says, yeah, he went to MIT with no degree, but he did get a physics degree from Duke.
Right. So. That's, I assume, how he met Ryan, or got in contact with him in some way. Yeah, and there was a character in there named Clark, and I was sort of briefly amused to see, was that actually a name call out to Arthur Clark? Because I'm pretty sure they would have known each other. The other thing that I remember by him was about a time traveler from sort of the classic Gernsbeckian, everything is perfect kind of future, but he is somebody with a time machine that has traveled even further forward and basically seen that the world is coming to an end.
Oh, so was he the one that did, he was the editor for Analog?
Yes, he was the lead editor for Analog.
Okay, that makes sense. Because I know I'd heard his name and I just couldn't quite place it. So does he have like a, is there a, was that an award or something like that?
Yes, the John W. Campbell Award is the award for new writers, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's one of the most famous names in science fiction.
Now, he also wrote Islands of Space, which has been generally credited with introducing the concepts of hyperspace and warp drive.
Oh, okay. So
maybe we'll have to pick that one in the future.
Maybe. So, then, until next time, we have been Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yeah.
Sci-fi. Sci-fi.